My name is Mary Grace, and this is the Homebody Podcast. And here we're exploring the home as a body and body as a home. I host spiritually and artfully minded conversations on embodiment, on approaching life as practice, artistic collaboration, and experiment. We'll talk about healing, art, aesthetics, magic, the practices we can bring to hone our intuition and live our life fully awake with our power intact. My hope is to encourage and enliven you and to also cultivate awareness and freedom. We're here to develop wisdom and self-trust and to be dynamic agents of beauty. We're here to design and be more intentional with the creation of our life. And we are here to make room for inquiry, sensitivity, and joy. Thank you for listening. Hello, everyone, and thank you so much for listening and welcome to this week's episode of the Homebody Podcast. I'm so delighted, so thrilled, excited to have Michael J. Morris on as this week's guest. It was so lovely to connect with them after many years apart, and we actually went to undergraduate school together, or we were in separate classes, but in the similar programs, in the beginning of the 2000s decade. And it was just such a joy to catch up. And I've followed them from a distance since then. And I've just always been fascinated and so enriched by their research, their integration of different topics and pulling them together into a convergence of practical application, just revolutionary thought in general. This episode is dense. It's full. I'm so excited to bring it to you. We talk about their consulting practice, some of their particular alchemy of tools that they use to give support to other people. And Michael also is a teacher. They have a PhD and they're a visiting professor currently at Denison University. And they teach the Department of Dance. They teach queer studies, women's and gender studies, environmental studies. So there's just a lot of intersectionality happening with their ideas and their offerings. We talk about postmodern dance and workshops and bringing together ideas around witchcraft and politics. We talk about eco-sexuality, we talk about pleasure activism, and we talk about embodiment and healing, we talk about yoga. There's kind of nothing that we don't talk about in here. And then towards the end, we come full circle around to some ideas around ethics and aesthetics and how those are often mirrors for each other. They are super articulate, and so I'm not going to even begin to try to summarize the density and the beauty of what we have to offer for you today. So let's get into the episode. So I usually let guests start by kind of introducing themselves and how they would define their roles, their work, what they spend their time doing in the world.
Yeah. So my name is Michael J. Morris. My pronouns are they, them, there. And how do I describe what I do in the world? I am a witch. I am an astrologer. I am an artist and a writer. I am a facilitator and an educator. I've been a yoga teacher for a long time. I have a consultation practice. I could dive into like the actual things I do. Those are some of the ways that I qualify my work, but I could describe the things that I'm doing in the world.
Perfect.
Yeah. So I have a consultation practice called Co-Witchcraft Offering, in which I center astrology and tarot, within the context of other, ritual meditation and healing modalities, really to support people in their own processes of healing, making meaning of their lives in a world that's constantly challenging us with senselessness. And ultimately all for hopefully the process of collective liberation. I'm also a professor. I have a PhD in dance studies, and I'm currently a visiting assistant professor at Denison University, where I teach in the Department of Dance and also the Queer Studies program, the Women's and Gender Studies program, and the Environmental Studies program. So that's sort of the sketch of what I'm doing right now.
Mm-hmm. I love that I've been kind of like, spying on your life since I think for, you know, since we kind of parted geographies, but you've always had this like stamina for research and just an ability and a persistence to be able to deal with like the density that ideas deserve. And I love that something that you have like an outlet for, and now people are just getting the benefit of like receiving all of that. I just love that you've ended up in a university doing your thing, because that's like a gift to the world. I think you're also the person that introduced me to yoga. I took my very first yoga class because you took me to a yoga class in college. I'd never taken it before. Whatever year that was. And now I teach yoga. So there's that. I know. So what are, you mentioned your consulting practice, and I'm really interested to kind of dive into that a little bit. Kind of your particular alchemy of tools. You mentioned like tarot and astrology, and I know that you also have like a yogic background. What is, what are the ways, do you just let the client or the person coming to you kind of call for what is needed? How do you kind of, what's the alchemy of all your tools? How do they talk to each other?
Yeah. So, when people are booking consults, in general, they choose either whether they're interested in working with astrology or tarot primarily. And both are really useful companions in this work. They do different things. So astrology, the kind of astrology that I practice is natal astrology, primarily looking at birth charts, studying birth charts. And my training and my study is mostly in Hellenistic astrology, which is the 2,000-year-old tradition. And so that is a kind of fixed map. It doesn't change. Once the birth chart is there, that is your birth chart for your life. And of course, we spend our whole lives unpacking that and reorienting. It comes to signify differently at different times in our lives. So the meanings and our ways of relating to that information change. But the birth chart is a consistent map. Whereas with something like tarot, we're sort of building the map each time we do a reading. We're accessing something that's nonlinear, more intuitive. We're making connections between different images, different associations, and allowing that to guide us towards the parts of our lives that need attention or need more awareness or more consciousness. And so most of the time, people are drawn to one of those two a little bit more than the other. I think sometimes it has to do with their existing experiences with one of the two forms. Very occasionally, I'll blend the two if it feels like there's something in the chart that we're not quite getting, or that feels like there's something hidden there. Sometimes we'll draw a card just to see is that another way in. But for the most part, they pick astrology or tarot. And then I guess the thing that's different in the way that I practice, or different than a lot of the other astrology readings that I've gotten, is that it's really important to me. And it's part of how I think the work functions well. If we actually take the time and use tools and strategies to shift consciousness into another state of receptivity. And so we start with some simple ritual practices, meditation practices, some magic, some calling in guides, calling in ancestors, creating a space between the worlds that allows us to hear and receive and engage with not only information, but also ourselves in a different way. And so that's how we begin. And then there's a strong emphasis in my practice as we move through the material, whether it's astrology or tarot. And then definitely this is how almost all of my sessions end, is bringing all of that information back to the body.
Yeah.
I'm a firm believer that our bodies are our truest guides. They're the part of the earth that we are most intimate with. They are not a vessel for our experience. They are the source of our experience. And so whatever comes up in the astrology or the tarot, what I'm most interested in is following that back to sensation. Mm-hmm. What comes up for you? What do you feel, and where do you feel it when you hear this information about your moon, or this information about your Venus, or when this card turns up next to that one? What information is coming up, or intuition or sensation is coming up for you? Because that's actually where I think the pathway to healing is opening, where the body starts to respond and say, that's landing somewhere, that's guiding me to some memory, some experience, some wisdom, something ancestral, something from my own lived experience. Yeah, so those are some of the ways that I bring, some of the things I bring into the room. I also have a Reiki practice. And so depending on who I'm working with and how open they are to something like Reiki, sometimes I'll do hands-on work, or sometimes I'll just give a kind of holding space as they bring their own attention and care to places in their body that are coming up in the consult.
Yeah, I love that. I just got Reiki attuned this year, and it's been such a gift. Yeah, I love it. I had my very first astrology reading. Like, I'd kind of read my own chart, but I had my very first time read it by someone else this year, and it was tremendously helpful. And I find that I love the way that you're pairing all of these things to bring it back to embodiment, to help kind of promote a shift in consciousness, so that people aren't just walking away with like information and like a cute picture of like juxtaposed images that are a map for my inner self. It's like, it's actually like landing in their nervous system so they can go forward with like a new consciousness and new experience. And I find that ritual is really helpful for just kind of, I mean, the point of ritual is to kind of physicalize things. Yeah, I just find that ritual is like so powerful for just like bringing light and making sure someone, you know, they just leave with like a revelation and not just like some info. I love that you're pairing all of that. What was kind of your epiphany to start your own practice?
Yeah, I mean, the world's on fire and the glaciers are melting. I don't know. We're living through such intensely complex times, and there is so much political despair. There's so much loneliness. There's such pervasive isolation. We're in periods of confronting a lot of systemic violence and systemic harm, and that's showing up in our bodies too. And so I love teaching. I love research. I love writing, and I love making art. And those things will always be part of my life. But I just felt like now is a moment where we need to be sharing our resources. We need to be making one another's lives more livable in whatever ways we can. And these practices, witchcraft and astrology and tarot and Reiki and breath work and meditation, like all of these things, these are the tools that have kept me afloat and kept me alive for the last 20 years. And it just felt like it's time to start finding ways to make those resources available to other people. I felt really inspired by some folks. There's a queer Jewish witch named Dori Midnight, who has an intuitive community-based healing practice in Massachusetts. And her work really inspired me into like, oh, you can do this. This can be a way that you contribute to the world. This can be a way that you could put this work at the center of your life if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. One of the early inspirations in my astrology practice was Chani Nicholas, who's blown up in the last few years because of the ways that she brings such a critical and compassionate feminist and queer lens to the ways that she's practicing and writing horoscopes and teaching. Like, I remember this was years ago. I was doing, I think it was a course on the moon in your chart.
Yeah.
And she was using example charts like Audre Lorde and Sylvia Rivera. And it was like, fuck yeah. I don't know if I can. Yeah, great. Fuck yeah.
Like, it's normally me.
These are the people that we want. These are the lives we want to be studying. These are our ancestors and our greatest teachers. And what happens when we shift this ancient lens to learning what their lives held for us? Mm-hmm. And so Chani Nicholas, Dori Midnight, seeing these people making contributions to the world in these ways, using these tools and resources as healing practices that are not only personal, but also collaborative in relationship, felt that's actually what feels so vital to me right now, is to be healing in relation. That's actually, so my consulting practice is called Co-Witchcraft Offering. Mm-hmm. And Co stands for a lot of things, but one of the reasons that word or syllable kept coming back to me is the etymology of co is with or together, mm-hmm. or mutually. And some of the things I believe really strongly about healing come from the healing justice framework, the idea that our personal healing can't be separate from our collective liberation. And that's folks like Kara Page and others who were really pioneering that framework. And so if we recognize that there's something about the wounds, the traumas, the harms that we carry that are not only our own, that we're carrying some part of something bigger, something systemic, something across our family lineage, across our lineage of possibility, that we're doing healing work not only for ourselves, which means maybe we can't do it in isolation. There's this book I'm reading right now called The Power of Attachment that's on healing attachment wounds. It's a psychology text. And I can't remember who the author is quoting, but she makes the point that we can't heal in isolation what was harmed in relationship. We have to heal in relationship because we were harmed in relationship. And so that's why the consulting practice just makes sense. It's not, for me, it's not enough to just put resources out in the world for people to try to find and read or listen to or something. It's being in conversation. It's being in, together in some process. That's where the healing takes place. And just felt like this was the time.
Yeah, it is the time for sure. I'm finding for me that the more I'm getting in touch with intuition is like the wrong word, just like kind of waking up to potentials around like connecting to the other side and like channeling and then being able to read in that way and listen in that way. It's just, it saves you so much time. And like, it's not only like efficient, but it's also, it just feels like how we're supposed to know already. And we have like technologied and we've mentally strapped ourselves into needing to prove everything with a calculator before we can make a move. And it's been really liberating for me personally to be able to lean on that more and more and more. And to know that like you hear what you hear and your experience, what you experience and your experience is correct. And that's been a really, and I love that you're using that voice to also just collaborate with other people and in a healing modality, which on purpose. And I love that. Do you want to mind sharing your, you said, what is your sun, moon, and rising?
My rising is Taurus. My sun is in Capricorn and my moon is in Gemini. And those things all matter deeply to me. And also one of the biggest insights for me when I started studying the Hellenistic astrology, is that the, already asking about the three is better than the sun sign astrology. But really the whole chart matters so much. There's so much in every planet, every sign, every house, their relationships to one another, all of the timing techniques, like it all unfolds so richly and complexly. But what the sun, moon, and rising give us, along with the ruler of the ascendant, is, and this is Demetra George's work. She's one of the people who are responsible for the revival of the Hellenistic techniques, which we have had no access to for hundreds, in some ways thousands of years, because these texts just hadn't been translated. Mm-hmm. And so it's really within the last 20, 30 years that there's been an effort to translate some of these ancient texts to really find what were the roots of this tradition. And then Demetra George, coming from a modern kind of almost psychological astrology, going back into those resources, she developed an approach that I use in my practice, which is a kind of reading for life's purpose and using the ascendant, the ruler of the ascendant, the sun and the moon as a map for what is your purpose here? And which may or may not be your career. It might be something else that you're here to do, or something else that you're here to center in your life in some way. And so the sun, moon, and rising, super important, along with everything else in the chart.
It is all very important. And yeah, because I think for me, you know, we all have sun, moon, and rising. And then, but I have like so much in Scorpio, and which is a really dominant part of my chart. And that is not my sun, my moon, nor my rising. And, you know, but it also has a lot to reflect with, you know, myself.
Yeah.
I want to shift now into some more kind of artistic research that you've been doing. You said that you have been doing some kind of group workshop and ritual work for the last few years that you called Dancing Body Magic. Mm-hmm. And I would love to hear more about that, particularly you developed these kind of rituals and workshops called Pleasurable Rites. based on, kind of inspired in a big way by Adrian Marie Brown's work. And I would love to hear more about what you guys are exploring, facilitating in community. I would love that.
Yeah, I think of this, this group work almost as a counterpoint to the one-on-one consultation work, using many of the same tools and strategies, just in a different kind of context. And it's showing up in a lot of different ways. It's been within the last 5 years that I started really becoming conscious of the possibilities of dance as ritual, which seems so obvious because Anna Halperin has been doing dance as ritual since the 1960s, not to mention that dance has been a ritual practice in most civilizations throughout the history of this species. So it seems so obvious, but I think because my dance journey came so intensely through academia, and really a strong entry point for me was postmodern dance in this kind of minimalist, formalist, Judson dance theater approach to dancing. I think it took me some time to find my way back into dance as a practice that could be about connection and healing and creating different possibilities for the world. And so it's been within the last, I don't know, since I finished my PhD that I've started opening back up to those possibilities and recognizing that ritual and spells and ceremony have been a rich part of my life all along. So what would that look like in the dance studio? Or in what ways is the dance studio actually already doing that? What if every dance that we made and practiced and practiced and practiced and performed in order to create a different way of feeling or a different way of thinking, what if that was already a ritual? What if that was already a spell?
Many friends right now that are going to be like having an orgasm listening to you say
wonderful.
That.
Great.
Yeah.
Especially with the pleasurable rites. That's like, it's part of it. So just practical things. In my own artistic practice, in my own compositional work, and in my teaching, I started exploring ritual structures, ritual scores from folks like Anna Halperin, Keith Hennessy, Sarah Shelton Mann, some folks in the dance tradition, in the postmodern dance tradition, who have been working with dance as ritual, as magic, as witchcraft, as healing for a long time. I also started exploring the embodiment of things that have been sort of abstract for me in my own process as a witch. So my witchcraft is pretty deeply inspired by Wicca and this sort of Euro-American, predominantly white witchcraft traditions with roots that are both actual and mythical in indigenous European earth-centered spiritual practices. And so with that comes a view of the elements as sacred, of air and fire and water and earth as sacred. And these get invoked in ritual. They get associated with different tarot cards, with different ritual tools. And I started doing a more embodied investigation of in what ways is the body already the altar? In what way am I air? Am I fire? In what way am I water and earth already? That they're not outside of me. They're not separate from me. That these sacred elements, part of what makes them sacred is that they connect us to a world of others to which we already belong. And so I started improvisational state-based movement explorations of what does it mean to move not like air, but as the air that I already am. What does it mean to move not like water, not imitating water, but letting the water of my body, like 60 to 80%, you know, depending on how hydrated I am, like, what would it mean to let that water dance, to let the bones, the earth, the minerals that have been here for 400 million years, if not longer, to let these minerals move? What if that and the fire and so on? So that was sort of my starting point in starting to do that work in classes that I was teaching. And then I have a brilliant collaborator, Kelly Klein, who went through the same PhD program that I did. And we started offering these workshops, Dancing Body Magic, together, which built on some of this work, the elemental embodiment work. Kelly also comes with backgrounds in sensory archiving that I think comes out of Liz Lerman's work. So it was very feeling and sensation-driven practices. We both have practices in tarot. And so we teach tarot as an entry point to healing practices. One of the things I love most that's come out of these workshops is using tarot as movement scores. So rather than pulling the cards and trying to read them with the little white book, or even just trying to interpret them mentally, what if you lay them out and just start moving through the cards? And what if that movement was the answer to your question? What if the cards and your way of moving them as a body is an answer or a guidance or an intuition of some kind? And then we also work with a practice that I learned from Keith Hennessy that was developed by Valentina Desideri called fake healing. She sometimes calls it fake therapy, which is basically an improvised healing practice that you make up with people. And there's some rules. It's sort of a game. And the rules to fake healing or fake therapy are: there's nothing wrong with the person that you're healing. You don't have the power to change the person that you're healing. And then give the best you've got. And so with those conditions in place of there's nothing wrong with them, you don't have the power to change them, and then you're going to give the best you can, people create the most beautiful, intimate, caring, compassionate improvisations with one another. And some of it looks like body work that they're making up on the spot. Some of it looks like cleansing or clearing rituals. Some of it looks like very mundane, like just holding and hugging, but people find their ways into the most intimate, caring forms of moving together in this practice, this fake healing practice. And then it's consistent. Like I've never facilitated it and this not been the experience that afterwards people say, you know, but the thing is, like, I actually feel better. I feel more healed. And it's like, well, exactly. It's only fake because we said it was fake. But we can't engage in a practice of connection and care without healing something. So those are just some of the things we work with. And then in the Pleasurable Rites series, we're focusing more specifically on awakening and expanding our access to pleasure. What does pleasure mean? What can pleasure mean? Working specifically from Adrienne Marie Brown's pleasure activism, but also Audre Lorde's The Uses of the Erotic, which was Adrienne Marie Brown's inspiration for the text. And Audre Lorde says in that essay that the erotic is not only a matter of what we do, it's a matter of how fully and how acutely we can feel in the doing. And that's really what the workshops are geared towards. How do we wake up to more feeling? How do we become more available to our bodies, to our embodiment? And then actually there's a contributor to pleasure activism who, I don't think she says this in the book. I think she said it in an interview. Her name is Amita Schwadin, and she makes a statement that healing is not just about feeling good. It's about feeling more. Yeah. First, we have to feel more in order to even to increase the capacities of pleasure. But then, I mean, Adrienne Marie Brown's point in the book is what if social justice was the most pleasurable experience we could imagine? What if we made all the labor and the work and the struggle for freedom and liberation, what if we brought pleasure, which means bringing our bodies into it, taking into consideration the needs, the desires, the wants, the longings of the body, because those things can be our guides towards something we can't imagine, which is justice and ethical coexistence. And so that's a workshop series that Kelly and I are also doing. And then I had the great joy to also co-facilitate with Keith Hennessy this past summer. We taught a week-long workshop called The Spiral of Fortune, The Seven of Birds, a laboratory for political witchcraft at an international art center called Ponderosa in Stolzenhagen, Germany. And then we brought that same workshop to Impulse Tanz, which is one of the largest international dance festivals in the world. And we're teaching political witchcraft to, like, I don't know. At the beginning of the week, we had like 40 students. By the end of the week, we had 60 something students. There just kept being more students doing this work. And it was so exciting, especially Keith is one of my teachers. Keith has been one of my inspirations in this work. And just through the process of knowing each other through community and workshops that I took with him, he felt moved to share this opportunity with me. So we got to teach political witchcraft as a dance practice in Germany and Vienna. And so, yeah, the group work feels super important. It's that same question or that same interest in connection, but rather than the one-on-one, it's what can we dream and make and invent and innovate and create together that none of us could have imagined on our own.
Yeah. What are the workshops? What did they reveal of political witchcraft? What is the living story of what that is as it's been revealed in those workshops?
Yeah, Keith and I are both coming from a fair amount of study. Mm-hmm. So in terms of historical study, actually this summer, Keith had just come from a residency in Norway, where they had created, several artists had been commissioned by the Norwegian government to create a performance ritual memorial for witches who had been burned in Norway. And so mm-hmm. as part of that, he was doing a lot of historical research about that part of the world. So both of us are bringing a pretty acute awareness of witchcraft historically being a condition of resistance or struggle. Like if we think back to the historical conditions under which we come to know something called witches, it's hundreds of years of persecution and execution, what we call the burning times, which I think Barbara Ehrenreich and Deirdre English in their little book, Nurses, Witches, Midwives, and Nurses, say that at the current moment, the most modest estimate of how many people were killed, mostly women, in that period were 50 to 60,000 people. So that's a genocide that we don't talk about enough. Most people don't even realize those numbers. And it's a really particular moment that Ehrenreich and English, people like Silvia Federici, who's a materialist feminist, kind of Marxist feminist writer, are examining what was happening historically and politically and culturally in this moment. And it's the birth of capitalism.
Yeah.
It's the shift from common lands into enclosures. It's the increased disproportionate distribution of wealth and resources across class lines. It's the formation of a male-dominated medical profession. It's the alliance between the state and the church to control and regulate the bodies and sexualities of really all people, but especially women. And the figure of the witch is sitting there at the center of this nexus. It's her body on the line in the midst of all of these cultural shifts. And so whether or not we know this history, when we say things like witchcraft or witches in 2019, we're aligning knowingly or unknowingly with this history of, I call it resistance. Maybe a more accurate term would be being in the way. That
yeah.
The women who were called witches were in the way of the birth of capitalism or the increased authority of the church and state. They held old knowledge of herbalism, birth and death practices, spiritual practices we might call them spiritual practices of working with charms and spells and potions that come from a much more animist view of the world than the view of industrial capitalism that gave birth to the Enlightenment. So this is a very different world that was coming into power in that moment. And the witch was in the way, whether she actually even thought of herself as a witch. She was called a witch and she was executed. And so you asked about the workshops, and that's the history, is that we're coming into these workshops with people knowingly calling it witchcraft,
because
this is history. And perhaps at this moment of such intense struggle with injustice, with systemic oppression, with white supremacy, with ongoing forms of empire, with heteropatriarchy, maybe there's knowledge that becomes available to us when we align ourselves with those histories and practices, when we reach backwards to traditional forms of knowing, like astrology, like tarot, like herbalism, like relating to plants and stones and the earth as our allies, as our kin, rather than as objects to be instrumentalized for human use.
Yeah.
That's what we're trying to bring into the room. And then also with artists, these are people who make things, especially at Ponderosa. We were in a room with I mean, the age range was like from people in their 20s to people in their 60s. And these were some sophisticated dance artists and makers and movers. And some of the places that we went were just mind-blowing. Like one day, this will just be an example and then I'll take a breath.
No, I love it. Keep going.
One day we were doing a day on time. And so we knew we wanted to do some time magic. And so we set a score, inspired loosely by Adrienne Marie Brown and also Angela Davis, that we wanted to, that the score was that we would work with the themes of urgency and slowness, and that the ritual that we improvised together would not be understood for 101 years. Hmm. What do you make under those conditions, knowing that you are experimenting with slowness and urgency, and it will not be understood for 101 years, which means we were all choosing in advance to not understand what we were doing, because that's what we have to do in order to pursue justice. None of us know what justice would look like. We don't know. We've never seen what it would be like if everyone had access to what they need, which is, I mean, is one way we could think about justice. We don't know what that would look like. We don't know how to get there. So then where do we practice doing what we don't know how to do in collaboration with other people? And I think that these workshops are a place that we're trying to support those efforts or build those skills or resources for doing what we don't know how to do in some sort of alignment with this history of persecution and resistance.
And the ongoing question of like, what does it look like to generate safe space for that experimentation, where people can feel safe with experimenting with what justice feels like?
Yes, safe space. Although that's a phrase that I've moved away from in the last couple of years. I think it was in 2014, Bell Hooks gave a talk with Laverne Cox at the New School. It's on YouTube. You can find it. Listeners, okay. You can find this on YouTube if you Google Bell Hooks and Laverne Cox.
I'll link it below. In the show notes, yeah.
I've watched it over and over. I'm teaching it in 2 weeks. And in it, Laverne Cox is talking to Bell Hooks about critical pedagogies, pedagogy of the oppressed, and makes a statement about the safe or safer spaces. And Bell Hooks interrupts her, and I'm going to paraphrase, but she basically says, you know, I'm quite critical of my early work on safe spaces. Mm. It seems like white people like to talk a lot about safe spaces. And perhaps what we need, what I've shifted more to, is rather than trying to provide conditions that are safe, which is not something we can actually promise, what if we provided conditions in which people felt supported in taking risk? Perfect. And so it's the idea of a brave space or a risky space where we might not be safe, but we are supported in the conditions of risk. And that feels like what we're doing in these workshops. And also, you know, of course, trying to create conditions of safety and support. But the risk and the bravery feels like where the emphasis is. Mm-hmm.
The courage of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. One thing I think I do want to kind of bring up to personalize it before we leave the topic of witchcraft is, how did those practices make their way into your life? When did you first start identifying that way? What is some of the evolution of that showing up in your life?
I mean, you're the perfect person to talk to about that because it's, you know, it's that period of my life. Actually, I was giving a talk. Oh, go ahead.
No, it's okay. I was like, I just always remember that being a part there. Of you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just gave a talk a couple of months ago on witchcraft and astrology as practices of healing. And the person who was kind of facilitating asked me a similar question, which made me go back and think, like, what's the story there? And I came to, there's like the official, or official is not the right word. It's like the more complete or concrete story, which starts in Jackson, Mississippi, my freshman year of college, when there is this store in Fondren in the arts district of Jackson called New Vibrations. I'm not even sure why I went there for the first time, but I found a home there. And I found the owner, Karen, and her sister, Gwen. And people who I came to think of as my lesbian fairy godmothers, really holding my hand through some tough years and embracing me and accepting me through all of that, and also teaching me tarot and also teaching me about crystals and gemstones as healing allies. And Gwen was the first Reiki practitioner I ever knew. And it was right across the street from Butterfly Yoga, where I deepened my yoga practice and really dove into tantric philosophy. Mm-hmm. So all of that really happened in that nexus of Jackson. And those were confusing years. I journaled all through those years. And if I go back, there's such a clear split consciousness where in one page I'll be writing about the significations of the lunar cycle and the full moon and the spells that I'm planning for the full moon. And during those years, I would go out to the Natchez Trace, and be at the reservoir and watch the moon rise over the water. And like, so it was such a clear physical engagement with these practices, but then the very next page would be full of scripture verses and a healthy amount of self-loathing, specifically around sexuality, but also stuff about gender that I didn't come to understand until later. And those were hard years, but those were the years where I really, it's undeniable that I was practicing witchcraft, that I was coming to understand myself as a witch, and that I was leaving Christianity in some way. But there's actually a more interesting or fragmentary version of this story, which is that if I go further back in the journals, it's actually in high school that I am sneaking away in the library and reading books on witchcraft. And I have this memory of reading a book on amulets from Middle Eastern cultures in the high school library. And I remember being in my bedroom in my parents' house late at night with the door closed, lighting candles and doing the best version of what I understood to be a spell at that time. And that was like, I could not integrate that. And in those years, something was starting to happen, but it wasn't integrated yet. And I think part of how I've come to think about those years is why witchcraft, what brought me to that. I think I already felt forbidden. I think even before I had language for myself as a queer person, I already knew that there was something about me that was forbidden, that put me on the outside of what I was trying to be, which was a Christian. And so I think I intuitively, instinctively went to the forbidden places seeking belonging, that I knew I did not belong inside the structures of patriarchal monotheism and the specific forms of evangelical Christianity that I was raised in and experiencing at Belhaven. So I knew I didn't belong there. And so I think none of this was cognizant. I think I was intuitively going to, where are the other forbidden places? And of course, witchcraft is at the top of the list. So, And it's not lost on me that when I stepped foot into New Vibrations, I found both queer community and witchcraft in the same place. So these narratives have been totally entangled for me all along. So then is it surprising to anyone that then witchcraft becomes one of the modalities for my own healing from the harms of patriarchy, from the repression and the aggression of heterosexism and so on?
Yeah. And I think, you know, we were talking a little bit when we were talking about the episode, how queerness, how magic, how art, how all these things have kind of, I mean, they converge because they converge within you and within your practice. And you've talked about how your idea of healing has shifted, your idea of what spirituality is has shifted, because you mentioned that you were just like kind of averse to the word spirituality for a really long time. Yeah. Do you mind talking about how those, because also those are changing shape as you're moving in towards these new practices and identities that feel more like you?
I guess I can start with healing. How has healing changed the most for me? Where I am now is informed a lot by Dory Midnight, who I mentioned earlier, but also Anna Halperin. Anna Halperin, in her work, is really clear and insistent about distinguishing healing from a cure, that healing is a process. It is nonlinear. It moves around again and again. with not necessarily having an endpoint, which we think of as the cure, the moment where it's done, it's complete.
Where you're healed.
And when you're healed. Yeah. What if being healed was actually about being in an ongoing form of relationship? What if it's not an endpoint, but a practice? And that's something that I really learned from Anna Halperin's work. And then Dory Midnight also brings a disability justice lens to her work. And she said for years she went exploring through different versions of what healing might mean. And that one of them was the idea of wholeness. And then she realized how ableist the idea of wholeness is. Mm-hmm. The idea that there is some version of whole that we could all be. And so that that definition didn't work anymore. And I think also coming from like a queer feminist post-structuralist lens, the idea, kind of suspicious of wholeness anyway. So there was like, healing doesn't have to be wholeness anymore. Great. then she says that she worked with the idea of aliveness, that healing was returning to aliveness, until she was in healing practices with people who were dying, that they were not going to come back to aliveness. And so then she came to the version that I think she's working with now. It's the one that I'm working with, which is that healing is the process and the practice of being in connection. And so what is healing? And this is actually related to where I've come with the ideas about spirituality, is recognizing our connection, being in practices of connection, whether that's with other people, like in the consulting practice, like in this call, like in the dance studio, or if it's more subtle. Like I think about how when I read astrology in the morning, when I look at the charts for the day, I am in relationship. I'm in connection to the sky, to the planets, to these constellations, but I'm also in connection and in relationship to this whole lineage of astrologers and scholars and librarians and people who kept this tradition alive, my teachers and their teachers and their teachers, that each time I sit with that practice, I'm not doing it alone. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, when I read tarot, I'm reading with artists and I'm reading with activists and revolutionaries who created the decks that I work with. I am working with mystics and seers and sages and witches, and they're all in the lineage of what I'm doing, which means I'm not doing it alone. Sometimes the healing takes the form of sitting. Actually, this is pretty frequent in my life right now, sitting with rocks, and recognizing that this is not just a tool. This is not just a commodity fetish or object, that this is has the potential to be a deep and abiding ongoing relationship of kin. So what does it mean to make time each day to sit and practice relationship with the stone, with the plants that I live with my human loved ones and human kin? And that's really integral to, I was trying to pull up the definition of spirituality from Brené Brown, that, as you said, like I had an aversion to that word after I left Christianity for a long time. And then actually being an academic, spiritual is kind of an anathema. Like, you don't, that's not a word that comes into,
right?
Unless you're in religious studies, that's a little woo. So I left that out for a long time. And then Brené Brown, working from grounded theory research, defines spirituality as recognizing and celebrating that we are all inextricably connected to each other by a power greater than all of us. And that our connection to that power and to one another is grounded in love and compassion. And when I heard that for the first time, I thought, yep, that's a version of spirituality that feels totally in alignment with my life, with my practices, with the kind of world that I want to live in, and is perhaps the container for everything that I just described as healing. What would it mean to recognize that we are already in countless connections, life-affirming relations of care? What would it be to live in our lives, to live through this world, with that being our ongoing consciousness?
I'm looking through what we were talking about, and something I have highlighted, which I think kind of bleeds into some of your university work and what you're teaching on. But you said that there's no possibility for ecological justice without changing our relationship to our bodies. You mm-hmm. cannot love the earth and hate your body.
Period.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's related to a lot of the work that I'm doing.
You're currently teaching issues in feminism and ecosexuality and the arts. Yeah. I'm super interested in, how those are kind of bleeding together for you right now, particularly around embodiment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's big. But
it's really big.
There are short versions. So ecosexuality was the focus of my doctoral research. That's what I wrote my dissertation about. And the short version of ecosexuality is that it's a framework for recognizing the ecological entanglement of our sex and sexuality, that sex and sexuality was never human, purely human in the first place. And so like some really easy inroads for people are things like the human microbiome, that our bodies, what we think of as our human bodies, are populated by more non-human DNA than human DNA, that there are countless, and by countless, I think I mean hundreds of species of bacteria in our mouths alone. And so that every sexual encounter or experience that someone has with themselves or with another person is already populated by countless more than human lives. And there's actually something instructive about that, because we are living through an intensification as we face climate collapse, we face the sixth great extinction. We're living through an intensification of human exceptionalism and anthropocentrism, the idea that the human is somehow separate from and more important than all other life on this planet, which is what is bringing us to the brink of extinction in the first place. And I see how strongly that shows up for people when we start talking about ecology and sexuality. There is such a resistance to even thinking about the ways in which the more than human is already a part of our sex lives, of our sexualities. And so I think there's intense work to be done there around sex and sexuality, sexual liberation, ecological justice, but then also what is our relationship to our own bodies, mm-hmm. such that we are willfully repressing what we know to be ecologically true, both interior, but also, the terms interior and exterior sort of dissolve as soon as you start thinking about bodies ecologically. And so that's the work that I've been focusing on academically for a while now, and specifically the ways that artists, specifically performing artists, have given us ways of thinking through or experiencing or recognizing things about the ecological entanglement of bodies and sexuality. So artists like Elizabeth Stevens and Annie Sprinkle, who were the first folks that I encountered using the word ecosexuality. And they had a series of performance, they still do them sometimes, a series of performance art weddings where they marry things like the earth and the sky and the sea. I'm twice married with them. I married the Appalachian Mountains and the sun, which can be just so grounding and settling when people ask things like, are you single? It's like, none of us are single. What does that even mean? Like, what do we have to ignore and repress in order to believe that we're single? What, in order to believe these lies of isolation and aloneness and loneliness? And so in the course that I'm teaching right now, I'm really drawing on ecofeminism, queer ecofeminism, ecowomanism, queer ecological studies, indigenous perspectives of land and sexuality, Donna Haraway's work, which is kind of a feminist biology for the Anthropocene. Folks like that, and trying to invite students into ways of thinking and experiencing their bodies that are more aware or more engaged with these ecological entanglements.
And more fluid.
Yeah. The flowing in and the flowing out is part of what it means to be a body.
Mm-hmm.
And what if we lived that? What if that was not just a thing that we thought, but we actually felt and experienced and re-signified our bodies as something that fluid? How would we live differently? And I think that that's going to be necessary for ecological justice. There's not a way to move into some form of justice for the planet without changing our relationship to our bodies. I mean, it reminds me of Audre Lorde writing that you can't dismantle the master's house using the master's tools. We inherited certain ideas of embodiment from centuries of Enlightenment thinking, Cartesian dualism, and heteropatriarchy. Like, we can't honestly believe that we can carry those understandings of our bodies forward into something like justice for the planet, which means we have to find new ways of relating to our bodies. And that's where the dancing and the ritual and the teaching, all of it kind of flows together into that reality mm-hmm. of recognizing a different way of being a body.
Yeah, totally. And have you encountered, does it strike you that there is a lot of fear around that idea?
Yeah. I mean, the things that immediately sprang to mind is every time I teach this work to students, questions of things that don't occur to me so much anymore, but like fear around dirt and dirtiness, mm-hmm. like all that stuff, that cultural baggage around purity and cleanliness and sanitation, which are like deeply culturally conditioned ideas, all of that comes springing up. Oftentimes when I'm talking about ecosexuality at conferences, but also with students, the question of consent comes up immediately because people start asking questions like, well, can the earth consent to a sexual relationship? And the answer to that is complicated, but the easy answer is, since when did we care about the earth's consent? Like, the earth didn't consent to that pipeline or industrial mm-hmm. agriculture or, you know, all of the minerals that we mine out of the earth in order to create our technology that we're using right now for this call. Like, since when did we care about consent in relation to the earth is a question we have to deal with. And why is consent only coming up mm-hmm. once we use the word sexual? Why is that? It seems more like an escape route. For me, it doesn't seem like it's actually a critical concern. But if we were to take seriously the consent of the earth in all these ways, then I think it's a worthy question. But perhaps more interesting is the fact that consent is a really human idea. And it's an important human idea. We need it because we have created intensely violent relations with one another. And so we need the concept and the practices of consent in order to do less harm. And maybe in that way, it's useful to relating to the earth. But I think it'd be much more interesting to ask, how does the earth teach us how to relate to it, mm-hmm. Rather than imposing these human frameworks onto that relationship?
100%. Kind of staying within kind of your research, that you also kind of incorporated a lot of study and research around yoga practice and theory. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that has also evolved a lot for you since you took your first yoga class at Butterfly Yoga.
Yeah.
To say the least. And you mentioned tantric philosophy specifically earlier. I kind of want to get into that research for you and what some of the kind of the epiphanies and some of the, what are some of the epiphanies that kind of came from that research based on maybe how a layperson is looking at yoga and experiences yoga through media or going just to your average studio versus what you found in your research to be kind of the goals and the practices?
Yeah, those are such important questions for us to be thinking about, especially as folks who teach yoga, who practice yoga. I think the thing that's changed the most for me since the beginning is recognizing that yoga is not primarily about exercise. It's not mm-hmm. about, it's not even about relaxation. It has nothing to do with flexibility per se, that it's actually a 5,000-year-old tradition of practice and philosophy really oriented towards liberation, that the we could say the goal of yoga, but I don't even like the idea of goal, that it is a practice of liberation. And it's a liberation that comes from recognizing union, from recognizing mm-hmm. that we are not separate, that there is a large self to which we all belong, a supreme consciousness that we are a part of. And all of the practices, all the branches of yoga, some of which Patanjali codified in the eight branches, the eight limbs of yoga, things like the yamas and the niyamas, the ethical precepts, but also pratyahara, the withdrawal of the senses, meditation, dhyana, dharana, asana, pranayama, all of it is leading to samadhi, which is the realization or the recognition of union. And if we were when we practice with that in mind, what we do and why we do it shifts pretty dramatically. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's less change oriented and more acceptance oriented. Like, we're not coming to class to get stronger or get skinny or to make ourselves more lovable. We're coming to the mat or coming to the practice. It's not even limited to the mat, in order to find that sense of belonging to something bigger. And I think, like, a big part of that for me has also been recognizing the intense whitewashing and colonization of this practice, mm-hmm. Which is complicated. It is not simple to be a white person who teaches this form. And even earlier this semester, we were in the class that I'm teaching at Denison this semester, we watched a video by Nisha Ahuja about decolonizing, or the colonization and decolonizing the yoga practice. And something, a point that she makes in that video and in the work that she does, is that you can't teach yoga. Yoga is an experience of union. You can't teach that. It's an experience. And I had students ask me, like, but aren't you our yoga teacher? And I was like, well, I am teaching a course called Yoga Theory and Practice, Practice and Theory, in which I am teaching you the practices of yoga, and I'm teaching you the theories, the philosophies of yoga, but I can't teach you enlightenment. Mm-hmm. All I can do is put the conditions in place for you to find that path that the teacher's within. And that's a tradition that doesn't begin with me. That's not my knowledge. I didn't come up with this, and it's really important. I think that gets lost in a lot of the studio practice too, the kind of like, what's a word for that? The kind of, I don't want to say it's ego driven, but the celebrity culture around,
totally.
Oh, the yoga teacher is amazing. She changed my life, or they did something incredible. And in what ways does the teacher get out of the way and actually bring a student in contact with this tradition that goes all the way back to India and other parts of South Asia that have been in deeply colonized lands? How do we make that transparent through the teaching that we do? I don't have answers to any of that, except for I've been in this practice for 20 years now. I've been teaching yoga for 10 years now, and those are the questions that I'm wrestling with at this point in my practice. And even this week, like yesterday I did a restorative class, because on Tuesday I often check in with the students, like, how are you doing? What's going on with you? And they used a lot of words like exhausted and overwhelmed and tired and depleted and sick and frustrated. So it's like, oh, maybe a restorative yoga class is what we need today. And specifically, I framed that for them as a practice of rest, and the ways in which Tricia Hirsi, who's the founder of the NAP ministry, mm-hmm. Teaches us so much about rest as a practice of resistance, that rest itself is potentially a decolonial practice. At the very least, it's a resistance to the capitalist impulse towards relentless productivity. And so how fantastic to be operating within this tradition of liberation, and in a context where students are receiving credit for this course and I'm getting paid to teach it, and we are choosing together in that time to rest. Mm-hmm. Like, how amazing to be able to have access to these resources, and then also to direct students back to what I'll just call the roots, because part of what we learn the more we study yoga is that there's not one tradition. There's not one authentic version of this tradition. In fact, it's a tradition that branches in many directions. But we know where its roots are, and we know some of the history of how it came to us. And if I can make that more present or more transparent in the ways that I facilitate, that's part of the goal for me.
Totally. Yeah, and to peel back those layers of urgency and accomplishment from it. Yeah, once I got more, I've been teaching a lot of embodiment practices for a while and then teaching yoga. And as I got more into the teaching, and I just realized how easy it was for what I was saying to be translated into, like, we're here to work on an arm balance. And I'm like, I don't give a shit about your arm balance. You know, like, I just like realized that way through. And I was like, I actually don't care about like any of that at all. And yeah, I've been doing a lot of Kundalini yoga lately and just really falling in love with it. And I love the way that that class is ordered. And to begin, it's just like, you know, basically consciously connecting to this golden chain of experience and then connecting that with the class and with the students. And then you really do, like, it's understood that you are out of the way. Like, you're not even practicing with them. Like, you're just, and while I don't teach Kundalini yoga, I'm not qualified to do so. I love that gesture has been really important for me as far as like how I hold space and how important it is for people to even really know that I'm in the room. Yeah. What are some of the shifts that you've made, kind of the more that you've dove into that and kind of reoriented your lens potentially? What has that looked like on a practical level as far as how you show up to your teaching or your practicing as a student or practitioner?
I'm centering consciousness far more. The only reason I can think of for us to do asana is to become more aware of what's possible already in this experience that we call the body. I spend a lot more time for myself in my day-to-day life in meditation than I do trying to achieve Panchamayurasana or something. Like, it's not
totally
not the goal anymore. Although I love that sensation of lifting off the ground into an arm balance. That's the point. It's the sensation of possibility that opens up, not look at this cool thing my body can do. Mm-hmm. If I can feel into more of what's possible, that's consciousness expanding in some way. And that's the point. But we have those experiences at the level of the subtle body and the energetic body just as much. And so I feel like I'm holding a lot more space for those kinds of experiences that the physical mechanical body is part of it, because that's where we live our experience. And also, how do we become more attentive to that flow, to the subtle energetics that we know through the chakras, through the nadis, it's also in my Reiki practice. Like, it's how do we tune into this other state that's actually already there, that's already present. And that tuning in, I actually don't even know if I said this earlier, but it's really the definition of magic that I work from the most, which comes from Dion Fortune. By way, I learned it from Starhawk, which is that magic is the art of changing consciousness at will. That so anything we do, any of these practices that we have that give us the agency to shift our experience, consciousness, our perception, that's magic for me. And so, and yoga has been one of the abiding traditions in that cluster of practices. That carrier bag for me is, how do I shift consciousness? Well, there are thousands of years of practice behind some breathing techniques called pranayama that give us some tools for shifting consciousness. Mm-hmm. There are ways of organizing our thinking or our experiencing of the body with the map of the subtle body and the chakras and the nadis, but also the koshas and the different vayus and the ways that energy flows and prana flows. Like, there are actually some really sophisticated traditions and technologies for shifting consciousness. And those have become as much, if not more, important than the asana practice for me at this point. sometimes I wonder if like in 10 years, I'm just going to be breathing and meditating and doing a yin practice every once in a while. Like, what if that's my yoga practice? And I'm not going to complain about it.
Yeah, no, probably so. I would gauge to say yes. I don't know if it's because we had this conversation at a super, the time in Jackson was also super formative for me and destructive for me in a lot of ways. But we had a conversation years ago in Fondren at the coffee shop, and you were diving into, and I was listening, to kind of this relationship between aesthetics and ethics. And you were talking about how what we think is good is also related to what we think of is the beautiful. And it's something that has given a lot of meaning to my investigations and experiments around the beautiful and the good in my own work and my own kind of personal philosophy. And I wanted to bring up, like, is this a relationship that you still consider, and how has that idea evolved for you? If it has.
Yeah, it's definitely stayed with me. I still believe that, I mean, that was a formative moment for me coming to recognize that our idea or our intuition or instinct about the good is embedded in what we find beautiful or in our philosophies of beauty or aesthetics. To the point where they kind of came full circle for me in the spring. I taught a course called Dancing into Worlds to Come, the Poetics of 20th and 21st Century Modern and Postmodern Dance. And it was ostensibly a history course, but it was not really a history course. We just happened to be moving chronologically through the 20th and 21st century. What we were really practicing was this idea of poetical analysis that came, or was kind of inspired by a scholar named Joan Redilak, and she says that poetics is a poetics thickened by an H. It's where the poetic, the creative, becomes concerned with the ethical. And some philosophers would probably say that, like, the ethical and the political are not the same thing. For me, they're close enough, because the ethical is how we live rightly with one another, and the political is the structures of power through which we do that. So we made a practice of watching dances from canonical and canonical choreographers and folks who have been left out of the canon, looking at what were the ethical structures being suggested or being performed or demonstrated in these dances. How do bodies relate to one another? What are the genders that we see visible on stage? What are the power dynamics in terms of partnering? Who gets to take up space? Who does not get to take up space? What's the relationship to the space, and so on? So asking these questions that were really about composition, but then trying to understand how might compositional choices, aesthetics, have something to say about how we live in the world. So that's showing up in that course, but also, I mean, I think that's embedded in the Dancing Body Magic work. I think it's embedded in the Spiral of Fortune, Seven of Birds, Political Witchcraft work. This question that what we do in one space has relevance or tells us something about what we do and how we live in other spaces. What if our dancing practices were, in a sense, divinatory practices, divination for how we live in the world, such that what we are holding as beautiful or aesthetically meaningful in one space is telling us or teaching us or reinforcing for us or potentially subverting for us the kind of world that we then want to live in. How might the practices that we do in the studio, in our artistic practices, but also in our ritual practices, how might they be practicing for the kind of world that we want to live in? And I think that's always true in dance and other modes of aesthetic or cultural production. So then if we become aware of that, what then do we do? What are the choices that we make? So, like, just as an example, in my own teaching, because I teach postmodern dance most semesters, what's the politics of do what I'm doing? of, yeah. I'm going to show you a phrase and you're going to do it the way I do it or as closely as possible. And I'm recognizing that it is possible for the seeds of fascism to be in that practice, even though that wasn't the intent. That what I'm trying to teach is movement, but I'm also teaching conformity. Is that what I want to be teaching? Is that the ethical world that I want to be practicing in this aesthetic tradition called postmodern dance? And so those are the kinds of questions that when I think about the beautiful and the good and the relationship between the aesthetic and the ethical, it comes back to these very practical things in terms of compositional choices in the performances that I make, but also in how I teach these forms. Mm-hmm. What's the kind of world that I want to live in, and how do we practice for that?
Yeah. And what am I asking for?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I love that. And it's really well said.
Thanks.
As always. What are you? It's true. Where is, if we want to find you, if we want to book a session with you, if we want to stay in touch with your studies, what are the best ways to stay alert to what you're doing and what you're investigating?
Yeah. The best way to learn more about my practice and to book a consult with me, if people are looking for those sorts of supports or resources, is my website, which is michaeljmorris.co. I'm on Instagram at co-witchcraftofferings, co-witchcraftofferings. I'm on Twitter at Morris Michael J, and I am on Facebook at co-witchcraftofferings.
Cool. And I'll hunt all of that down and we'll put it in the show notes so people can just like click and find a thing. I will definitely be booking a session. That will be happening. Really excited about that. I'm so thrilled that you took time out of your, what I'm sure is a very full life, to sit down and have a conversation with me. It's been a pleasure. And I'm like so happy to connect with you and also just hear what you've been working on. It feels very rich and exciting to think about for the next coming months for sure.
Yeah. Thanks for inviting me into this conversation. Meet these sorts of connections. This is really what it's for. This is what it's about. This is what we just did. This is practicing for the kind of world that I want to live in. So I'm so grateful to just be able to connect with you about these ideas and bring a story that's been in process for a long time into another set of considerations.
Totally. All right. Thank you so much, Michael.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the conversation, please leave us a 5-star review, subscribe to the show, and consider sharing the episode. I would love to hear your thoughts. Feel free to tag me on Instagram or send me a DM. I would love to meet you and hear what you thought about the conversation, and we'll see you next week.